This is Audible.
Mission Day Press presents a Punch Audio production of Radical Inclusion, What the Post-9/11 World Should Have Taught Us About Leadership. Written by Martin Dempsey and Ori Braffman. Narrated by Alex Hyde-White.
Dedications. I'm Marty Dempsey, and I dedicate this book to those who showed me the real meaning of leadership. My grandparents, who had the courage to leave their home in Ireland with the simple hope of making a better life in the land of opportunity that is America. My parents, who sacrificed absolutely everything for their five children. My wife and lifelong partner, Deanie, who has always been the real leader in the Dempsey family. My three children, Chris, Megan, and Katie, who encouraged me to pursue a career of service, and who then joined me in that life. My protégés, who were in a very special way, also my mentors. I've been blessed to learn from the best, and now hope to share the knowledge with you.
I am Ori Braffman, and I dedicate this book to my parents, Tzila and Chagai, and my brother Ram, all of whom have shown me unwavering acceptance throughout my life, and to all those who have taught me important lessons about inclusion. From the deserts of El Paso to Black Rock City, and from the halls of UC Berkeley's Peace and Conflict Studies Department, to the tiny office of Vegan Action.
Preface. Often the best things result from the most unexpected collaborations. Based on this belief, a belief at the very core of this book, we set out to examine today's leadership environment and to share some insights about how to navigate it. We concluded that a 41-year-old UC Berkeley professor and a 41-year veteran U.S. Army general have very little in common, except a deep and unwavering belief that most of the hard problems we face in our businesses, in our local communities, at the national level, and internationally, can be solved with better leadership. Along the way, we learned that listening to each other was the first and most important step in our journey, and that including diverse perspectives always produced surprising and valuable leadership insights. Ultimately, we arrived at a message and how we would deliver it, a task that felt both more difficult and more important with the passage of time. We feel a genuine urgency about our message. Few would dispute our assertion that the world began to change dramatically in 2001, but we have found the character and pace of change since 2001 more remarkable than we expected. Challenges to the predictable and familiar order of things in business, government, international relations, and even our sense of national identity, increasing religious extremism, the emergence of global peer competitors, the proliferation of technology, and, since about 2010, ubiquitous access to data and information for virtually everybody all the time, everywhere. Status quo companies, militaries, countries, those that for a very long time enjoyed unchallenged power, are now palpably fearful that their power is eroding. Their instinct is to exert control. It's the wrong instinct. Although the world has changed, the way we think about leadership hasn't kept pace. Often the result is suboptimal objectives decided upon too late, measured with the wrong metrics, and implemented with overconfidence by a workforce that is not sufficiently empowered to deliver them. This book challenges us to refresh our thinking about leadership. It's not that the things we've always done as leaders won't work anymore. In fact, we will suggest that some of them should be reinforced, but we'll also suggest that there are several emerging leadership principles and instincts that are gaining in importance and that demand careful thought and serious consideration. That is, if we want our leadership to match the times and meet their challenges. To be sure, this book was written during a period of considerable political disagreement about our country's future, especially about how much selectivity to exert about who belongs within and who is excluded outside our borders and our communities. But this book is not a commentary on political leadership. While we'd like to think that it has something to offer to those who have been elected to lead the country through the most pressing issues of our time, we believe that it will most strongly resonate among organizational leaders, especially those facing industry, market, and cultural transformations. This book is an exploration of what happens when there's a mutation in the very core DNA of an organization. Whether it's being a member of a family, attending a school, or serving our country, belonging to a community or a cause bigger than ourselves is core to our very humanity in three specific ways. Belonging shapes our identity. It provides our sense of security, and it creates the order we need to survive. We develop our identity based on the communities we join. I'm a dad. I'm an American. I'm a soldier. Being part of a community, in turn, provides us with security. When a parent sacrifices everything for their kids, when a teammate stays late to help a coworker finish a project, and in a thousand other ways, being a part of a community means that there are others who are committed to our success. Finally, in being a part of a community, we can expect our fellow members to abide by a certain set of rules, making our day-to-day existence predictable and thus productive. Part of the very contract of belonging, though, is exclusion. We cluster ourselves in neighborhoods, hold tryouts for sports teams, and require exams for certain schools, thereby creating a sense of belonging among those who make the cut. Soldiers will often do anything, even against their own interests, to help a fellow combatant. This bond is so strong that we have a name for it, brothers in arms. You are brothers because you both gone through boot camp, you both wear the same uniform, you both fight for the same country. But what happens when there's a simple change in a company's organizational structure, or even a country's? Rather than being selective, or having any barriers to entry at all, what happens when a community is open for anyone to join? We'll begin by looking at the forces knocking down organizational fences and checkpoints. We'll explore how selectivity, border control, if you will, comes at an economic cost that may or may not make sense. What are the costs of control? Clearly, there's a measurable economic price to keeping a sentry at the gate, but in exerting control, we may be paying a more serious but harder to measure cost. The ability to accurately view reality. Indeed, it has become a cliché to say that we live in a complex, unpredictable, and rapidly changing world. So cliché, in fact, that we fail to appreciate how profoundly people are affected by it. In 1770, John Adams declared that facts are stubborn things. Today, we argue, facts are vulnerable. Emerging technology is making facts increasingly vulnerable, and all of us will soon have trouble discerning what is actually true. Simply put, we're about to enter an age where facts will no longer be reliable. The information we think is 100% accurate may be flawed, and even our best attempt to find the truth may fall short. In a 2004 book, Ralph Keyes used the term post-truth to describe an emerging period in our history where the borders blur between truth and lies, honesty and dishonesty, fiction and non-fiction. We build on that observation and explore what the world will look like when, to gain understanding of the reality around us, there is no longer a debate of facts, but rather a competition of narratives. As competing narratives vie to present a picture of the world, we will have a harder time determining what's real and accurate. Welcome to the era of the digital echo, where information passes from individual to individual more quickly, but in the process often becomes distorted. We will explain the phenomenon of the digital echo in great detail, but it is important to note from the start that it is a neutral force. It can inform, misinform, educate, entertain, inspire the human spirit to great acts of compassion, or unleash mankind's darkest instincts. It can inspire the generosity of the ice bucket challenge or the hatred of the ISIS terrorist ideology. It presents both a leadership challenge and a leadership opportunity. One thing is clear about the digital echo. It creates the need for inclusion. In this new world, we need to leverage inclusion to gain better information about the world around us and to effectively communicate our message. In order to help you accomplish these two imperatives, we provide concrete leadership tools to create an environment of inclusion. 1. Belonging isn't optional. Give them memories. We will argue that the first step in building a team is developing in its members a sense of belonging. Consider the alternative. If leaders don't make those who follow feel a sense of belonging, someone or something else will. And the ubiquitous presence of the digital echo makes this not only possible, but likely. 2. Connect effort with meaning. Make it matter. We will show that persuading members of the team that their contributions matter is crucial to team success. We all want to believe we make a difference. Leaders help their followers understand what that takes. 3. Think about what you're not thinking about. Learn to imagine. We will encourage leaders to develop mindfulness, awareness, and imagination through a lifelong commitment to learning. We believe and will convince all who aspire to lead that imagination is a learned attribute. 4. Prevent decision paralysis. Develop a bias for action. We will demonstrate that, when presented with a problem, leaders must look for what they can do in the moment. They must avoid information paralysis. They must act to change the environment and to learn, and then act again in a deliberate pattern of persistent learning and proactive leadership. 5. Collaborate at every level of the organization. Co-create context. We will discuss how the most effective leaders harvest knowledge and empower the organization from bottom to top. We will show the benefits of concentrating the what while distributing the how. 6. Expand the circle. Relinquish control to build and sustain power. We will assert in the strongest terms that finding optimal, enduring, affordable solutions to complex problems requires leaders to reconsider and rebalance their understanding of the relationship among leadership, power, and control. The leadership instincts are listen, amplify, include. Neither the principles nor the instincts are an a la carte menu. Effective leaders must understand and practice all of them. We've titled our book Radical Inclusion because we believe that the traditional relationship among leadership, power, and control has changed. Solving our problems by leading with an emphasis on exclusion, jealously husbanding power, and aspiring to greater control is producing suboptimal, fragile, and costly outcomes. The alternative is to rebalance the relationship among leadership, power, and control with an emphasis on inclusion, to selectively and purposefully relinquish control to enhance power, to define success less in terms of power and control and more in the ability, in order to achieve optimal, enduring, and affordable outcomes. Counterintuitive? Perhaps. But as the digital echo spreads, as complex issues multiply, as uncertainty increases, as technology exponentially changes, and as risk rises, it seems reasonable that we should seek to lead by sharing our challenges rather than owning them outright. That said, this book's proposition about leadership is not that we ought to surrender our hard-earned power because possessing it is becoming a liability. Rather, it is that we must develop an instinct for seeking opportunities to share control in order to preserve and even enhance the power we possess. Ours is a pragmatic proposal. We advocate sharing control in problem solving, not because we wish to become somehow more egalitarian, but because we want to solve problems effectively and efficiently, and we want them to stay solved. Finally, we chose the adjective radical to describe the kind of inclusion we advocate because it speaks to the extremes we encounter as leaders in the world today. It is our belief that concentrations of power and exclusivity will continue to form but cannot endure in a world that sees all, a world in which technology levels all, a numbingly fast-paced world of rising expectations, glaring disparities, and declining trust. If we're right about that, about the environment in which the affairs of business, industry, international relations, and national security must be managed, then only the leader who can harness the power inherent in inclusion will make lasting progress and achieve enduring success. Part 1. The Operating Environment. Chapter 1. The Digital Echo. The Fog of War descends on Berkeley. Berkeley Police Sergeant Sabrina Reink wore a clear and focused expression when we talked to her in the basement of Sproul Hall on the UC Berkeley campus. The sergeant's voice nonetheless shifted as she told us, "In the entire history of the campus, what happened is unprecedented. We didn't expect something like this." By unprecedented, the sergeant meant Molotov cocktails, damaged property, and masked perpetrators who were either right-wing extremists, paid agitators, or anarchists out of control. In the blink of an eye, Berkeley had turned into a war zone. Dozens of civilians took to the streets and engaged in full-on armed conflict. What was most alarming was that the violence seemed to emerge out of nowhere. The police were taken so completely by surprise that they simply stood by and watched. The shockwaves from the day's events reached all the way to the White House, escalating tensions between the federal government and the state of California. And no one saw it coming. Wednesday, February 1st, 2017, started out as a glorious Bay Area day. Over the previous month, after years of severe drought, California had finally been getting the drenching it so desperately needed. This week offered a respite from the rain. As temperatures rose in the afternoon, UC Berkeley students basked in glimpses of sunshine as they lounged on the steps of Sproul Hall. Unlike the manicured palm-lined drives of Stanford, its arch rival an hour to the south, Cal has a decidedly gritty feel to it. It's an urban campus where you're as likely to run across a drum circle as you are to be caught up in a political debate. The guy in front of you in line for coffee could be a hippie, or he could be a Nobel laureate. Cal has reserved parking spots for Nobel Prize recipients. Or he could be both. While the tech startups and venture capitalists may get more attention, it's impossible to understand Silicon Valley without understanding what's happening at Berkeley. We often think of the transformational innovation coming from San Jose, Cupertino, and Mountain View, all home to the massive tech companies. Likewise, in Menlo Park and Palo Alto, venture capital funds deploy billions of dollars. But Berkeley is the epicenter of social imagination, the place where the conscience of Silicon Valley originates. It was on the Sproul Hall steps that Mario Savio stood to lead the free speech movement, and he walked through the administration building's doors for the very first sit-ins just 40 years ago. This is where protest movements from civil rights to animal rights were launched. Berkeley is no stranger to diversity of speech, and the campus is no stranger to controversial voices. At the peak of the AIDS epidemic, for instance, Professor Peter Duisberg gave a talk claiming that HIV wasn't caused by a virus, but was instead the product of drugs and a party lifestyle. Protesters objected to the presentation, predicting that it would impact HIV policy, and, indeed, South Africa went on to base its policies on Duisberg's theories. For decades, the campus has prided itself on being accepting of an eclectic cast of characters, from religious protesters to anti-nuclear activists to proud nudists. So tolerant are the campus and community of a variety of speech that local businesses sometimes sponsor protesters, paying them to display ads on the backs of their picket signs. When outspoken conservative activist Milo Yiannopoulos announced that Berkeley would be his final stop on the year-long tour he had dubbed an all-out war on social justice, while you couldn't have expected the student body to be thrilled, you wouldn't have expected an actual war. At one university on the tour, his appearance led to the resignation of the chancellor. At another appearance, the protests grew so tense that a bystander was shot in the abdomen. Fearing similar outcomes, other universities preemptively canceled Yiannopoulos' appearances. On the day of his appearance at Berkeley, tensions were running high. Student anxiety over Yiannopoulos' speech wasn't necessarily about the views he might express. Various campus groups worried that he might do something like call out undocumented students, as rumors to that effect had been swirling on social media and were validated by an open letter sent to Berkeley students on February 1st by the university's Office of Student Affairs. University officials feared violent clashes among protesters. The University of California Police Department stepped in, requiring the Berkeley College Republicans to raise $10,000 to cover the costs of security, which initially seemed to pay off, as the evening started with a peaceful protest and dance party against the rainbow-illuminated backdrop of the administration building. Here's where things took a turn. According to one version of events, reported by national media and believed by those in our nation's capital inclined to think the worst of Berkeley, at 5:39 p.m., student protesters began moving to block the venue entrance. And 21 minutes later, Milo was evacuated. At 6:03 p.m., students shot fireworks at the building, and over the next 10 minutes, the protesters broke fences and windows. In response, police fired rubber bullets and tear gas into the crowd. Things only escalated from there, as protesters broke the windows of the student building and threw Molotov cocktails erupting in flames that lit up Sproul Plaza. The next day, the White House escalated the situation further with a thinly veiled threat. If Berkeley couldn't keep student violence from erupting over speech, perhaps the university wasn't deserving of federal funds. Politics aside, you can see the origin of the concern. How could a campus that prides itself on tolerance condone vandalism and violent behavior by its students? Indeed, playing Monday morning quarterback, you might think that the university should have exerted more control, hiring more police officers and vetting student groups to prevent the chaos that ensued. But something didn't add up. When we dug a little deeper, we found that the administration, the media, and virtually everyone else following the story had gotten it completely wrong. The problem with the students are to blame version of events is that the student organizers of the protest were residents of a co-op that abided by non-violent ideologies. Think about that for a moment. These are students with majors like development studies and environmental science who toss around phrases like community spirit and global consciousness. Sure, they might be guilty of smoking pot, but they aren't the Molotov cocktail-throwing type. In fact, knowing that the protests might create tensions, the organizers actually went to great effort to underscore their nonviolent intentions. "We are not here to engage in physical confrontation," they wrote on the flyer they distributed to draw a crowd. "We will protect each other," they continued, "to ensure our democratic right to protest and our safety." The event invitation even included safety tips for attendees, a number to dial in case of medical emergency, and instructions on how to spot the trained legal observers who would be present to document potential provocateurs and any incidents that might occur. The student body was organized and ready to carry out its peaceful protest, as had so many others outside Sproul Hall over the decades. But somehow, everything went wrong. The violence intensified so rapidly that no one saw it coming, and no one knew exactly who or what was behind it. Even Sergeant Reich couldn't explain it. People who have been to battle know that the most dangerous attacks don't announce their arrival. The most lethal attack is the one that catches us by surprise. The military describes such blindness to impending attack as the fog of war, the myriad things you may not know about your adversary, their location, numbers, capabilities, and goals. But think about this. What if the fog not only denied you access to the facts, but actually convinced you of the validity of erroneous data? From a business perspective, imagine not merely being unsure about the number of your customers, but being certain of an incorrect number. It's under this condition of believing wrong information that the most difficult issues emerge and take us by surprise. There is always some fog present, and organizations try to diffuse it as best they can. The military uses on-the-ground scouts, communications intercepts, high-resolution satellites, and night vision technology to track and assess the enemy. Businesses analyze market trends to identify and outmaneuver the competition. But what if the information you see deceives rather than informs you? The real danger in battle and in business wars is that you may be convinced you have a clear picture when you don't actually understand what you're seeing. That's exactly what happened in Berkeley. Without anyone realizing it, the fog of war enveloped the campus. The attack wasn't at all what it appeared to be. This brings us back to our conversation with Sergeant Reich. She, along with the rest of her police force, is dedicated to protecting the campus and the community. But in order to protect against an attack, you need to know who's waging it. This fundamental question, who incited the Berkeley violence, has ramifications far beyond the Berkeley police or even the city itself. As Reich and her colleagues tried to make sense of what was happening during the protests, operatives from both political parties on the national level were composing their own narratives about what was going on. When violence breaks out at a protest, fingers naturally point at the organizers themselves. But as we have noted, these particular organizers were of the non-violent type. Gandhi could have learned a thing or two from them about organizing peacefully. Even if we are to believe that the culprits were the student organizers, who, regardless of their co-op lives, did turn violent, why would they target, of all the buildings on campus, the student building, the one that houses all the student clubs, which, wait for it, skew heavily progressive? It would be out of character for them to do so. They had no motive for targeting that part of campus, and they had no history of such behavior. Either something completely unexpected happened that morphed these peace-loving liberals into hyper-aggressive militants, or there's more to the story. That's exactly what Reich thought when she looked at the events. Something just didn't make sense. But if the student organizers didn't cause the violence, who did? We believe, Sergeant Reich told us, that these were paid anarchists. If it sounds like a wild conspiracy theory, it is. There is no evidence that anyone was paid, and no one knows anything about who these so-called anarchists might even be. But here's a Berkeley police sergeant admitting that this is her leading theory. At this point, the only thing we can be certain of is that the fog of war lay thick on the city of Berkeley, drifting to cover everyone nationwide who was trying to make heads or tails of the situation. But if paid anarchists were responsible for the Berkeley violence, who paid them? One narrative holds that the anarchists were paid by one of the far-left extremist groups behind the riot, Refuse Fascism, said to have received $50,000 from a group backed by socialist billionaire George Soros. The theory was that anti-fascists started several fires, smashed windows and ATMs, looted downtown stores, attacked cars, and assaulted dozens of Milo Yiannopoulos fans. Why, though, would a left-leaning organization and a respectable funder hire thugs to vandalize arguably the most progressive university in the country? This is where yet a third theory of events enters the picture. Under this theory, the anarchists weren't paid by the left. Rather, Yiannopoulos and Breitbart were in cahoots with the agitators, laying the groundwork for a White House crackdown on liberal universities and their federal funding. In a blog post about why the protests turned violent, Berkeley professors drew a connection among Yiannopoulos, Steve Bannon, and President Donald Trump, suggesting that the violence could have been coordinated to support the president's call during his campaign to revoke federal funding for UC Berkeley. And thus we have three competing accounts, each troubling in its own right. Were Berkeley students out of control? Did communists pay agitators to vandalize the campus? Or did conservatives and affiliated media stage a coordinated information operations campaign? At least two of these theories had to be wrong, and one of them had to be right. Right? Maybe not. What if the police, the university professors, the government, and the media reported the events as they saw them, but were all mistaken? In trying to figure out who the perpetrators were that night, we discover a global trend and a battle being waged right under our noses but unrecognized by even the most careful of observers. Uncle Shoe Store. At a family Christmas party, Ori found himself in a conversation with an uncle who's a professor of philosophy, specializing in language and epistemology. The two were talking about fake news and how, in the near future, the trend might affect our ability to discern the truth. Halfway through the conversation, they were joined by another uncle, a physical therapist who runs a specialty shoe store for athletes. This uncle is one of the top experts in the country on running shoes, and even holds a patent on a machine that tests a shoe's stability to gauge its appropriateness for a given runner. The conversation, as tends to happen at family events, turned to global affairs. Uncle Shoe Store mentioned that he'd read about a Harvard professor who demonstrated that climate change science is wrong. "I mean, look around," he continued. "It's not hot this winter in San Francisco." Of course, Uncle Philosopher is at the opposite end of the political spectrum, so Ori bit his tongue and sat back to watch the fireworks. Instead of engaging in an argument, Uncle Philosopher asked Uncle Shoe Store how he'd reached his conclusions. Uncle Shoe Store said that he had read the information online and that a number of his friends, all successful business owners, had read and agreed with the same materials. Uncle Philosopher tried to ask about the multitude of peer-reviewed journal articles backing climate change, but Uncle Shoe Store put little stock in them. Just as Ori kept his mouth shut at Christmas, we're not going to weigh in on climate change. For a moment, though, let's view Uncle Shoe Store from the perspective of someone who believes in climate change. We need to recognize that Uncle Shoe Store isn't simply spouting unfounded beliefs. He is actually being rational, reading up on climate change in his favorite publications, seeing what the people he trusts on social media say, etc., and coming to a rational, albeit debatable, conclusion. He's in no way irrational. He's reached a conclusion based on both the data in front of him and the so-called wisdom of the crowd. In other words, not only does he find the data compelling, but he's verifying it via a statistically established methodology. He's just not necessarily aware that the crowd whose wisdom he's tapping may be decidedly biased. As much as we might feel superior to someone who holds an alternative view of scientific data, we all are soon going to suffer the same fate. What Uncle Shoe Store didn't account for as he gathered information and formed judgments was the digital echo. He wasn't alone. There soon will come a time when, despite using all the resources available to us, we will simply not be able to tell what is actually true. This, as we'll soon see, is what happened at the Berkeley protest. Let's look at two other examples. First, consider a recent hoax in which, with the aid of bots, the Twitterverse was convinced that a Louisiana chemical plant had gone up in flames. Local news even reported on the fire. They eventually got the facts right when they sent a reporter to the scene, But what happens when local news gets replaced by distributed networks? In other words, what will happen when anyone can produce a news story? In a case like this false fire, social media might have two versions of the same story. One would say there was no fire, showing a video of the unburned site, and then there would be another narrative, with photos purporting to show the explosion and its victims. Now, what does that mean for a future allegation of, say, the use of chemical weapons in Syria, or of some kind of warfare engaged in by the U.S. government? Will the public be able to discern what is actually real? In the second example, Mao intent wasn't even a factor. On December 27, 2016, 2 days after the family Christmas party, a protester threw some firecrackers at a government building in Bangkok. This triggered a Facebook alert for an explosion, based on an unnamed trusted third party, and users proceeded to mark themselves safe. The Facebook alert linked to a news story that referenced BBC breaking news footage of an explosion in Bangkok that had happened a year earlier. News outlets saw the BBC logo and, in their rush to cover what appeared to be a major breaking story, overlooked the date on the video and hastily posted their own stories about the explosion. Footnote: Facebook safety check creates false alarm in Bangkok. BBC.com. December 28, 2016. Of course, the error was quickly discovered and the Facebook alert was taken down. In the old days, newspapers wouldn't even have had time to take the story to print. Television news outlets that covered it would have run a correction, and that would have been that. But with news traveling at the speed of links and clicks, news of the explosion spread around the globe within minutes and continued to spread even after Facebook corrected its error. And so, if you Googled December 27, 2016 bombing in Thailand, there was a good chance that your top search result would be a story based on inaccurate data. It's not always accurate to call instances like these fake news. They can occur without any intentional deception. An inaccurate news story, even an accidentally inaccurate one, creates a digital echo. And though the original source may be corrected, the echo, reverberating across distributed networks, endures forever. What really happened in Berkeley, we think? Recall that we had three competing narratives about who was responsible for the violence and vandalism at Berkeley. Our first narrative blamed the students. Our second blamed anarchists paid by conservative institutions. And our third blamed the same anarchists, but had them paid by the far left. Unsatisfied with the UC Berkeley police's explanation, Ori continued to dig. He talked to a student who used to work for U.S. intelligence, but got no answers. He asked other faculty, but they were equally perplexed. Ultimately, he remembered that one of his students had written a paper on anarchist structures, and turned to him for insight. The student didn't want to talk on the phone, so Ori met him at a dive restaurant near campus. So, do you have any info? Which narrative is correct?
None of them, the student said. They're all wrong.
And so we present narrative 4, as told by Ori's student. Anarchists did indeed attend the protest. They smashed the windows of Amazon and bank outlets within the student center to express their dissatisfaction with the economic divide. They weren't paid by anyone, and in fact were so wary of being found out that they didn't even communicate via social media. At some point during the night, a heat lamp fell down and caught fire. There were no Molotov cocktails. These kids didn't know how to make one. But when the media reported that firebombs had been thrown, the UC police thought the campus was actually under paramilitary attack. Instead of making arrests, they retreated in the face of what they believed to be a superior force. The situation, therefore, wasn't contained and continued to spiral out of control. In other words, the digital echo affected real-time police action, which allowed the situation to escalate. We underscore that no law enforcement individuals acted negligently. Just like Uncle Shoe Store, they responded in a rational manner to the information presented to them. That information originated from unreliable sources, but was quickly amplified by being retweeted, reposted, and repeated to the point where it appeared legitimate. They fell victim to the digital echo. It could happen to any of us. In a world where verifying facts is becoming increasingly difficult, inclusion is imperative. It gives us sources as close to the ground or the action as possible, providing our best chance of getting at the truth. Despite our best efforts, there will still be times when truth cannot be reliably distinguished from fiction. In the absence of verifiable truth, competing narratives will vie for allegiance. When we are forced to compete in a battle of narratives, inclusion is still our best weapon. Only by leveraging a diversity of voices can we create a winning narrative. Chapter 2. The Power of Narrative. McDonald's versus McVegan. To begin our investigation, we remain on Sproul Plaza, but go back in time. 22 years before the Milo Yiannopoulos protests, in 1995, Ori was pulling a metal wagon along Sproul, the very spot where the agitators, whoever they were, would wage their attack. Ori normally walks with a hurried stride, but you wouldn't have guessed it from his pace that day, which was nearly a crawl. His load was heavy. 2 folding chairs, a card table, 20 stacks of pamphlets bound with thick blue rubber bands, and a dozen or so signs affixed to cardboard backing, all balanced atop a red wagon that had started its life as a toy for kids. Now, having been donated to the cause, it was covered in political stickers. The wagon's front left and rear right wheels wobbled under the weight of its cargo. Ta-dump-a-dump, 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 they groaned as they rolled over the smallest bumps in the concrete. There were also psychological reasons for Ori's slow pace. He wasn't just pulling a heavy wagon, he was feeling heavy as well. Simply put, he dreaded arriving at his destination a few hundred feet away on Sproul Plaza, along one of 2 rows where student clubs tabled about their particular causes. He found an open spot between the lacrosse club and an environmental group. Ori began by unfolding the card table, then organized the pamphlets into 4 neat rows. Pamphlets on animal research at Berkeley were in the first row, information about the abuse of primates in the second, the philosophical arguments for animal rights in the third, and miscellaneous pamphlets explaining the history of animal rights in the fourth. Next, he put up a poster for his group, a vivid photo of a chimpanzee strapped to a metal contraption with the block letter words, "Berkeley Students for Animal Liberation," underneath. He sighed. It was time for the debates to start. Ironically, Ori had joined the group to meet new people. He was putting himself through college, and to save money, rather than splurge on a dorm room, he lived on the wrong side of town with a schizophrenic who spent nights arguing with the voices in his head. A freshman living off campus and a committed vegan, Ori had hoped he'd meet like-minded friends. Instead, here he was engaging in a debate with a biochemistry PhD candidate about the efficacy of animal studies. "You're all idealists who don't know what you're talking about," the scientist said, his voice rising. Ori tried to take a reasoned approach, but the tension only mounted. Meanwhile, the guy at the lacrosse table was engaged in a lengthy conversation with a tanned freshman interested in joining intramural sessions. How Ori wished he had joined lacrosse, or even the environmental club, where a group of hippies were talking about a beach cleanup project. At least those 2 groups attracted potential members. Things came to a head a few weeks later, when BSAL organized its first protest of the semester. After doing rigorous recruiting, making special signs, and obtaining a permit from the city, BSAL staged a day-long protest outside a McDonald's. Out of the tens of thousands of Berkeley students, 7 people showed up. The tiny group held up signs showing photographs taken in slaughterhouses and gave out pamphlets describing the difficult conditions within them. The hope was that the graphic imagery would sway opinions. "Wait a second," a passerby might say. "I respect animals, and this place tortures them?" That conversation never happened. Instead, people engaged Ori in so-called debates, which were more like one-sided tirades about why he was wrong and or crazy. And those who didn't engage in such debates, the vast majority of people, that is, ignored him and his fellow protesters. And when we say ignore, we mean ignore. It was as if the animal rights activists were phantoms. But Ori was undeterred. By noon, the group had stood out in front of McDonald's for 3 hours. They had given out hundreds of flyers, but hadn't actually dissuaded anyone from going in. Then, a middle-aged woman, her kid in tow, walked toward the group. She looked like she could be one of Ori's mom's friends, friendly and kind, a woman in whose home he could have grown up. The nice lady approached the group, and Ori and his peers smiled at her. "Finally, here's someone on our side," they thought. But the woman said nothing. Instead, she came up to the guy standing next to Ori and literally spit in his face. As she walked away, she yelled toward the stunned protesters, "Stuck up elitists!" It was an ironic epithet to hurl at a group of activists who wore second-hand clothes and persisted primarily on lentils and cabbage. But at the same time, whatever you might think of the politeness of spitting in someone's face, the woman came from an understandable place. Here she was trying to take her kid out for a fun, affordable meal, and a bunch of protesters were calling her immoral. Let's face it, health food is more expensive and difficult to find than ubiquitous McDonald's restaurants. What gave these holier-than-thou protesters the right to tell her what she should do? If mothers were spitting at you, Ori reasoned, clearly something needed to change. He realized that he and his fellow BSAL members were losing the debate. Over the next months, they put the protests on hold and strategized about how to actually make a difference, how to get through to the people they were trying to reach. The group came up with a number of ideas for new tactics, but Ori realized that no matter what they did, BSAL couldn't compete with groups like the Lacrosse Club. It just wasn't as fun. Then one evening, Ori and his friend Lior Jacoby allowed themselves to dream. "Imagine if we opened up a veggie burger place across from McDonald's," Ori said. "With an even better playground outside," Lior added. "Yeah," Ori continued, "we'd call it McVegan." There was a pause. A smile spreading across his face, Lior said, "We can do that." "Open a restaurant?" Ori asked. "No, create the parody." Lior spoke with alacrity. "Give veggie burgers away on Sproul." Lior sat down at his Mac that night and stayed glued to Photoshop for the next couple of days. The design he came up with featured the famous golden arches, but instead of the familiar slogan, it read, "McVegan. Billions and billions saved." It's important to note that just a few years earlier, unless he worked at an ad agency, Lior wouldn't have had access to a computer able to perform this design work, but now, working in his little room at home, what he produced was perfect. McVegan represented a new tactic. Create a positive narrative around being vegan. Being vegan is fun. It's hip. All your friends are doing it. The next day, Ori, Lior, and their friend Mark Schlossberg started vegan.org. It was also the day that Ori killed BSAL. Immediately, the president of every major animal rights group called him to yell at him, "You're killing the animal rights movement." "Yes, that's the idea," he responded. It wasn't that he had anything against animal rights. It was just that he'd realized that the debate couldn't be won because of the barriers it erected. For one thing, Scientists who used animals in their labs could not, by definition, be a part of the movement. That left an entire group, a group of very smart people, many of whom conducted their research in hopes of helping other people by curing a disease or gaining knowledge about health, inherently excluded. What's more, in a debate about morality and the role of animals, could you say for sure that you were right and that the other side was wrong? Let's pause for a moment. Ask yourself, how many times during your personal or professional life have you been on the right side of an argument but been unable to convince others around you? How many teams have you been a part of that felt excluded from the overall organization? And even if you've never held a protest sign in your life, how many times have you felt that you were speaking to deaf ears? Now, imagine what a pain it was to teach people about veganism, of all things. Remember that at the time, in the mid-1990s, very few people even knew the word vegan. This was long before the numerous studies showing the benefits of a plant-based diet. Most people knew that vegetarianism meant not eating animals, but vegans avoid all animal-derived products, no eggs, dairy, or leather. To add to the challenges, vegan is not exactly a melodious word that rolls off your tongue. It's a branding choice no marketing person would ever come up with. Ori realized that either he could earnestly make the case for giving up animal products, or he could take a page from McDonald's book. The objective of McVegan was to make veganism inclusive, even of non-vegans. Rather than engage in a debate, it created a narrative where veganism was palatable, fun, even funny. If the fast food chain was using clowns and playgrounds to promote its food, why couldn't Ori do the same? Wearing T-shirts bearing the golden arches and accompanied by the McVegan mascot, Reggie McVeggie, Ori's group gave out free veggie burgers. And after months and months of tabling for animal rights only to be ignored, suddenly the McVegan stand was mobbed by curious students. Within an hour, they had given out more than 1,000 veggie burgers. Moreover, even non-vegans, ye olde carnivores, loved the T-shirts so much that they asked to buy them. All of a sudden, people loved the activists. Veganism was becoming a cool, fun counterculture movement, and no one was spitting in anyone's face. Lior and Ori printed colorful T-shirts and stickers and started selling them to punk rock kids at concerts. The kids would stick them on their shoes, their bikes, their hats. The logo was becoming a fun fashion accessory. One day, Ori spotted a kid on a bike with a McVegan sticker. "Did you get that at Gilman?" he asked the kid.
"Where?"
the kid answered, unaware of the alternative venue where punk rock bands like Green Day performed before they made it big.
"No, dude, I got it from my friend. He gave it to me because I work at McDonald's."
McVegan was equally appealing to punk rockers, to people who didn't like the idea of corporate fast food, to kids who wanted to rebel, and to those who just thought it was funny. You could wear a McVegan T-shirt and still eat a Big Mac. Soon other colleges held their own McVegan events, inspired by the narrative. But not everyone thought it was funny. Many of Ori's friends in the environmental movement argued that McVegan still encouraged consumerism. They argued that McVegan belittled a serious issue. The fact that someone could wear a T-shirt and still consume meat was evidence, they argued, that the path to societal change was to defend the facts and work toward policy changes. The other folks who weren't amused, unsurprisingly, were McDonald's executives and lawyers. Just as McVegan was gaining a little bit of attention, McDonald's threatened to sue for trademark violation. Uh-oh. How can you possibly win against McDonald's? Lior, Ori, and Mark huddled and ultimately made the decision based on their bicycles. Specifically, the bikes were pretty much their only possessions, so what did they have to lose? They decided to fight back, but not in the way you'd expect. They realized that, unlike their previous protests, this wouldn't be a debate. McVegan and Reggie McVeggie were literal clowns who were causing McDonald's a whole lot of grief. At that point, McDonald's had to make a choice. The natural inclination, the obvious strategy, was to get rid of the clowns, to silence them. Indeed, that's what McDonald's tried to do. That's when something weird happened. By attacking McVegan, McDonald's was only shining light on Reggie McVeggie, only giving him more prominence and inadvertently amplifying the narrative. And McVegan was simply more fun and more hip than McDonald's. All of a sudden, T-shirt and sticker orders were coming in from around the world. That's when Ori had a fundamental realization. As the underdog, it's easier to engage in a war of narratives than it is to win a debate on the merits. Because McVegan was inclusive, because anyone could be a part of it, there was no one, other than McDonald's, who was terribly offended by it or set against it. After a number of positive news stories broke, reporters were calling to get the McVegan side of the story, but rather than engage in a debate, Ori dressed up as Reggie McVeggie and held a press conference. The next day, McDonald's dropped its case. Now, what if McDonald's had chosen a different strategy? Rather than trying to win the debate, what if it had recognized that it was engaged in a battle of narratives? This is the first major element of the new environment shaping our world. Narratives, as we'll see, are having greater and greater impact in industries and on the world political stage alike. More specifically, the world is moving from debates about facts to battles of narratives. Facts are about being right or wrong. McDonald's believed it was wrong for McVegan to have violated the trademark. But narratives aren't as concerned with who is right and who is wrong. They're focused on who's more interesting. Facts are by definition grounded in logic. Narratives, however, are based on emotions. McVegan wasn't about whether it's logical to eat a beef burger or a soy alternative. It was simply declaring that the alternative was fun. McVegan was powerful in the same way that a clown in a circus or a jester in a royal court has power. A jester can mock the king by distilling one attribute, twisting it, and giving it a new and funny interpretation. Reggie McVeggie gave a new spin to Ronald McDonald. What if healthy eating were fun? Facts need to be verified in order to have utility, but narratives gain power merely by spreading. Each punk rock kid who put a McVegan sticker on his or her bike to protest commercialism spread the narrative, as did each McDonald's employee who did so as a joke. Thus, McVegan mutated and could be both a critique of fast food and a good-natured spoof. Unlike facts, no one expects narratives to be exacting. They are derivatives of the truth, not pure versions of it. Thus, they're allowed to be more flexible and agile, because they spread by being interesting, not necessarily by being accurate. They don't have to be scientifically on point. They just need to have a compelling plot. This brings us to the core of the issue. Facts depend on expert validation to persist, while narratives simply need to be retold. That means that you can't win a narrative battle by simply proving that the opposing narrative is in some way inaccurate. A narrative battle is won by drowning out the countermessage. Imagine if instead of viewing McVegan and Reggie McVeggie as adversaries to be silenced, McDonald's had taken a page from Shakespeare's King Lear, who noted that jesters do oft prove prophets. In other words, what if McVegan was onto an emerging trend? Indeed, while Ori hasn't done any work on McVegan since 1995, the concept endured. In 2015, industry publication AgWeb posted an article with a title that would have seemed impossible 2 decades earlier. McVegan, former McDonald's CEO joining board of Beyond Meat, a veggie burger maker. Don Thompson, former McDonald's CEO, had turned veggie burger enthusiast. It wasn't necessarily that Thompson had a philosophical change of heart about burgers. Rather, he was following market demands. He wasn't the only business executive who warmed up to veggie burgers. Bill Gates joined a version of the McVegan campaign as well. More on that later. The point is that veganism, thanks to inclusive narratives, is no longer on the fringe of society. In fact, just a few weeks before this book went to press, news broke that McDonald's itself was testing a new vegan burger. Its name? The McVegan. Reference footnote.